Hello, my name is Chelsea DuBall. As we said, I'm from the University of Rhode Island, and today we will be looking at an estuarian environment from a soils approach, looking into a portion of my master's research, assessing impacts of oyster aquaculture in Rhode Island's coastal lagoons using subaqueous soils and benthic macro in fauna. So I first want to start by defining what is aquaculture. As you can see, it comes in a lot of shapes, sizes, varieties, but by definition, aquaculture is the breeding, rearing, and harvesting of plants, animals, and all types of water environments. So that includes marine systems, estuarian systems, as well as freshwater systems. And in Rhode Island, it looks a little something like this. And for our aquaculture in the state, 98% is oyster aquaculture. So to set the scene a little bit more, do I have a pointer?
There we go.
Okay. So, I don't actually know how to... Perfect. Okay. For those of you who aren't aware of where Rhode Island is located on the map, it's tucked away here between Massachusetts and Connecticut, right on the coast. So 50% of aquaculture within our state is actually located in this coastal salt pond region. So as I had mentioned before, coastal lagoons, they're locally identified as coastal salt ponds, as you'll see in my title within the program. So a significant portion of the industry is sited in these coastal environments, which, as you can see here, are located right behind what we call a barrier beach. Most of these ponds have permanent breachways. They are typically brackish water, but as you can tell with that permanent breachway, have higher salinity levels. So how do these oysters impact the environment? Oysters are bivalve filter feeders. One single adult oyster can filter upwards of 55 gallons of water per day, in the process naturally grazing on what occurs or naturally thrives within those waters, including particulate matter, phytoplankton, and free suspended nutrients. So as they metabolize those nutrients and phytoplankton into their tissues and shells, whatever isn't processed is excreted onto the soil surface and into the water column via biodeposits. So concentrations of nitrogen, phosphorus, and carbon. So what my research focuses on is how those biodeposits, or those nutrient mass loads, are impacting the soil environment. So those soil processes, soil properties, as well as what's living within those soils. So looking into these biodeposit feeders and how we see those nutrients being buried within those soils. So for our research, my primary objective is to investigate the impacts of oyster aquaculture on the coastal lagoon environment, and we plan to do this by assessing the effects of oyster-derived nutrient inputs, so those biodeposits, on those soil properties and benthic and fauna. Our hypotheses, to begin, we assume that oyster aquaculture will increase nitrogen inputs, again, via those biodeposits, to the soil over both increased densities, so stocking densities of those oysters, the organisms themselves, and continuous aquaculture use, so over time of using aquaculture practices in place. We also hypothesize that with these nitrogen inputs, the soils will eventually reach a level where the benthic communities and the soil properties will begin to change. Which brings me to my final hypotheses, which we'll focus on for the duration of this presentation, is that we expect higher sulfide levels, nitrogen burial, and populations of opportunistic in fauna within the soils of those aquaculture sites. So just to orient you again, here we are on the south coast of Rhode Island. Our study focused in on three specific coastal ponds. We have Winnipeg Pond, Nanigrit Pond, and Potter Pond here all have permanent breachways, as well as in those barrier beach environments, kind of set back from salt marshes as well. Again, brackish waters have significant sulfide content. We have this handy tool called the soil web. We're fortunate in Rhode Island that we have our subaqueous soils currently mapped in these estuarian environments. So this helped us to select our specific sites. As I had mentioned, we have our three ponds. Within each of those ponds,
We have pre-existing aquaculture areas or aquaculture farms. And each of those farms is actually located on the same soil type, which is called a Nagant sand, roughly 93 to 97% sand. So really sandy materials, let me go back a little bit here, located on what we call a washover fan. So again, set right behind that barrier beach location. So you can see what that soil profile looks like there. And then from Google Earth aerial imagery, we can see what these aquaculture farms actually look like, which is pretty cool. And using a special time hop tool within Google Earth, we were able to stratify different ages of aquaculture use. So as you can see, this would be an entire farm in itself. And there's different parcels that were established in different years. So it enabled us to stratify our age sites from 0 to 21 years of aquaculture use, as you'll see further in my presentation. So what were our parameters? Like I said, we looked into our sulfide levels, our nitrogen burial, and the benthic and fauna within these soils. So to begin, we looked into those soil pore water sulfides. Why are we interested in looking into these sulfides? As you may know, sulfides are toxic or detrimental to infauna and those living organisms within the soil environment. And to analyze this, we used what we call an indicator of reduction in soils, or iris tube method, which actually, in the title, is used as an indicator of reduction in soils, but we use it to identify, as a rapid field assessment, the sulfide levels within those soils. So we do that by inserting these PVC pipes that are coated in an iron oxide paint, as you see here, down to 20 centimeters within the soil. And from there, the sulfides within the soil reduce the iron paint on that tube, further causing the insoluble iron sulfides to accumulate on these PVC cores, as you see here, which leaves behind this darker black color, those insoluble iron sulfides, as I had mentioned. So I know this is a bit of a busy slide, but if we look at our control sites with no aquaculture use, we don't see much of a color change here. Most of that orange color has remained, aside from a few blotches. But if we look at our aquaculture sites, it's almost entirely black, a full color change, indicating that we have higher sulfide contents within our aquaculture areas, as well as specifically, it might be hard to see, but in that upper 10 centimeters of the soil surface, you see that prominent black change. So if we look a bit further into our soil properties, we also looked at nitrogen burial at depth. To orient you here, we have our total N in grams per kilogram of soil and our duration of aquaculture use. So again, those different age sites ranging from 0 to 21. And then we have our depth increments of those soil cores. So 0 to 20 centimeters, represented by the different colors. So if we look at age 0, our control sites, we notice that we start to see nitrogen burial from the surface down to the lower 10 centimeters of our soil profile. So that's a naturally occurring process. But if we look further into our aquaculture sites, around the 5 to 12 year sites specifically, we see higher levels or burial of our nitrogen occurring, which is pretty interesting. In addition, once we reach those older sites, like the 13-year, the 21-year, we see less of those, less accumulation of nitrogen in the deeper depths of those cores, or the soil profile, I should say. So, to see how things are interacting with these changes within our soil environment, we did a extended benthic and fauna analysis. So this included identifying our infauna out to the species level and later to our functional feeding groups to look into the different trophic interactions occurring within the soil environment. So here we have our top 5 species, which actually comprised roughly 70% of the total populations that we saw within these soils. What you'll notice here is that control and aquaculture sites have similar species at both. But what's interesting is we start to see sort of this trophic shift, where at our control sites, our majority are interface feeders, which I should mention are your feeders that go between deposit functional feeding groups as well as your scavenger feeding groups. So they're kind of between the two and do both. So we see more interface suspension and scavenger feeders, but if we look at our aquaculture areas, we have mostly deposit feeders. So we're starting to see a shift into the more opportunistic species. And more specifically, we see this Capitella capitata, which is noted in the literature, to inhabit highly disturbed areas. So that's a highly opportunistic species, and we see nearly our populations here doubling. It goes from roughly 8% to 16% at those aquaculture areas. So confirming that we're seeing that shift to more opportunistic species within these environments. So to look a bit further into our functional feeding groups, again, to orient you, we have our number of organisms, and that's per core for a sample size of 5 cores. It's a total of that 20 centimeters, which we sampled for the soils as well. And we have our duration of aquaculture use, again, in years. So ranging from 0 upwards to 21, we start to see that there's this big peak in abundance of not only our specific functional feeding groups, but our total abundance, as you can see in that yellow line. So that's very interesting within our aquaculture areas, but it's specifically between the ages of 6 to 12 years of aquaculture use. And again, our highest abundance are those deposits as well as interface feeders. But even more interesting is we see it start to level off around this 13 to 20 year range. So that's when we start to question, are there predator-prey interactions coming in here? Because we see it almost reverting back to initial conditions before any aquaculture was established. So to conclude, we'll look back at my initial hypotheses is what we expected in these aquaculture areas. So we expected them to have higher sulfide levels, which we did observe in our aquaculture areas. Again, sulfides can be toxic to benthic in fauna. We saw higher nutrient burial, yes, between the control sites as well, but we saw more within our aquaculture areas. And we saw higher populations of infauna shifting towards more opportunistic species, lower trophic levels. And what's interesting about that is we did see more individuals, but they were opportunistic. So you may start to see this impact of those sulfides not making those infauna completely leave the system, but we are starting to see somewhat of a shift, potentially in quality. So with that, I will take any questions and put a nice plug in for my poster this afternoon to look at the other side of the equation, which is the water quality and how that's impacted by the oysters. Thank you.